On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm John Hockenberry, and this is On Point. In the news this week, a mixed bag or a grab bag? Incumbents are nervous about the early signs of voter revolt in some primaries. Iran tells the world to mind its own business regarding its nuclear program. The president tells America that staying the course in Iraq is tough medicine that will make our lives better in the end. The polls are dubious. After making $1 billion for Paramount, Tom Cruise is out of a job. Do you want to take up a collection? A year after Katrina and the sun is shining for now over the Gulf. How's the rebuilding? And there's that whole story about the little beauty queen. What's her name? I'll think of it. This hour on Point, a look back at this week with our own Knights of the Round Table. We have a terrific panel to dig in and see what details are going to matter most in the weeks ahead. Joining me now from Washington is Juliet Eilperin, national correspondent for The Washington Post. She is author of Fight Club Politics, How Partisanship is Poisoning the House of Representatives. Juliet, welcome.
Thanks, John.
And with us from New York, John McWhorter, senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute and author of Winning the Race, Beyond the Crisis in Black America. John, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, of course, Jack Beatty, On Point news analyst and senior editor at The Atlantic Monthly. Jack?
Hello, John. Pleasure to talk to you. And Juliet and John, hello.
Great. Thanks so much. Well, Juliet, let's begin with you. Your top stories, how do you figure it shakes out?
Well, the top story I have this week is John McCain's comments, which he delivered in Ohio on Tuesday when he was stumping on behalf of Senator Mike DeWine, a Republican in a very tough Senate race, when he talked about the administration's characterization of the war in Iraq. And he said this kind of talk contributed enormously to the frustration that Americans feel today because we were led to believe this would be some kind of day at the beach, which many of us understand, you know, he said it was an exaggeration. And I think that kind of tough talk about Iraq from someone who's traditionally supported the president is pretty significant.
Well, it's certainly hard to figure out how this campaign season is going to play out. That's for sure. McCain's speaking, I mean, the Lieberman race, all these primaries that are going on. It's a little nervous to be an incumbent, I would think.
Absolutely, particularly when you consider Frank Murkowski. I mean, granted, that's not a congressional race, but he's a former senator, the governor of Alaska, who came in third out of three candidates in the Republican primary this week. So, you know, if incumbents weren't nervous enough, having the sitting governor come in third with 19% of the vote is a bad omen as well.
John McWhorter, what's your top story?
Well, I think given the fact that we do have certain clearly very urgent issues going on, such as what just happened in Lebanon, such as what's going on in Iran, and, for example, even something as important as the advance in stem cell research, I'm worried that there's been a kind of a cluster over the past couple of weeks, actually, of purported examples of hate speech. And so we go from Mel Gibson stumbling out of his car slandering Jews, which clearly is something that we need to think about, to Andrew Young, the pioneer civil rights leader of all people, being raked over the coals for mentioning that shopkeepers in inner cities have often overcharged poor black people, and sticking in that the shopkeepers have not been black, which is part of a kind of a ritual statement of black solidarity that's been common in black communities, but was not meant as a racist rant against people who were Jewish, Arab, or Korean. Or, of course, the rather cartoonish example of Senator George Allen from Virginia calling someone a macaca in a kind of a towel-snapping locker room way, making up this silly word, and there being these labored attempts to fashion macaca into a racial slur that he supposedly actually offered up in front of a camera that a Democratic operative, who he knew was a Democratic operative, was aiming at him at the time. So it just seems to me that we're creating a kind of a theatrical show of pretending to think that people are hurling racial slurs often when there's so many things that are more important for us to pay attention to, both on the race scene as well as in the world that we live in.
So this is a grasping at racial straws. I have to say the George Allen thing was a complete mystery to me. I could not figure that one out, although the Mel Gibson thing seems pretty straightforward.
Yeah, I mean, there's no denying. He cannot come out and say, well, I'm not a racist. Clearly, we've got a problem there. But with Allen, it was just a matter of clumsiness. And I think a lot of us have our moments of clumsiness. And it's just the kind of attention. It seems that it's becoming kind of a show. And so big surprise that Survivor, the television show, is actually going to pit whites and blacks against each other in teams in order to bring up the ratings. Some of this is just becoming kind of formulaic instead of being about real things. And
wait a minute.
Race is a problem.
Survivor's going to have racially distinct teams next season?
Yeah, doesn't that sound almost like a fantasy? But they're going to pit whites and blacks and Hispanics against each other. That was the news from yesterday.
Hasn't that reality show been going on for about 230 years in the United
States? Oh, yeah. It came on with Milton Berle, and so people are getting a little tired of it. And so now they're pulling that to bring in the ratings, and I'm sure it'll work because race so often is a show these days.
Jack Beatty, what's your number one?
Well, you know, with George Allen, this just didn't come out of the blue. There's a history there of what one could call, I think charitably, insensitivity, and what others might call, by stronger words, toward minorities. This man had a Confederate flag in his office. According to an article in the New Republic, he actually had a noose in his office, a hang noose, at one point. When he graduated from high school, he wore a little lapel pin showing the Confederate flag. On and on. He voted against Martin Luther King's making it a holiday when he was in the Virginia legislature. So there's a whole history here of racial insensitivity, and it was almost part of his persona for a while. He's tried to come back from that, but this didn't happen in a vacuum. It isn't just as if this is the only thing he's ever said that could be construed in that way. Ironically, of course, the race he's in against Jim Webb himself, it seems to me, was guilty of some very poor taste in a flyer he put out. The flyer, and I'm reading here, ran against a man named Miller, who was a businessman, and the flyer it showed a man with a grotesquely hooked nose and cash falling out of his pocket. And the ad says, "Are you finding out ways to put people out of business?" Mr. Miller was a businessman; he was buying out other companies and so on. And then it called him the Antichrist of outsourcing. And of course, the man was Jewish. This is the flyer put out by Jim Webb. So there's a lot of this insensitivity and crudeness. Jim Webb did not apologize, though, for this.
Well, you know, we certainly learned this week that saying the wrong thing on quite a different note and a different subject can have, you know, multi-million-dollar consequences. Tom Cruise said something about Brooke Shields on the Today Show a while back, and his employer took some action. Let's recall what Tom Cruise exactly said.
I want to see her do well. And I know that psychiatry is a pseudoscience.
But Tom, if she said that this particular thing helped her feel better, whether it was the antidepressant or going to a counselor or a psychiatrist, isn't that enough?
Matt, you have to understand this. Here we are today, where I talk out against drugs and psychiatric abuses, of electric shocking people, okay, against their will, of drugging children with them not knowing the effects of these drugs. Do you know what Adderall is? Do you know Ritalin? Do you know now that Ritalin is a street drug? Do you understand that?
The difference is
I'm asking you a question.
I understand abuse of all of these things.
No, you see, here's the problem. You don't know the history of psychiatry. I do.
That's right, Matt. Matt Lauer talking with Tom Cruise. Juliet, we're all just one conversation with Matt Lauer away from unemployment, I gather. Language is important.
This is true. You got to be careful. But I have to say, I don't think too many people are crying over this split between Paramount and Tom Cruise. I think it's nice that there are actually consequences to craziness, even if you're a successful star. I think the fact that particularly, I think what's interesting is it's women and young women who deserted Tom Cruise in his latest Mission Impossible movie. And I think the fact that, you know, people can vote with their pocketbooks and say, you know, first of all, you might question whether that's a movie you want to see, but the fact that people were turned off by both those kinds of comments and, of course, his relationship with a much younger woman, you know, that's fine. That's just letting the marketplace do its work.
And it all comes down to language, John McWhorter. It starts with language and it turns into headlines.
Yeah, it does. And, you know, to be perfectly honest, I think that things like this make us a little bit more mature as a society. The key to this is that Tom Cruise, because of the unbuttoning of our culture and because of the proliferation of our media can have conversations and reveal his actual self in ways that, say, a Gary Cooper would not have. There's no way Gary Cooper would have been on the radio and talking about what he purports to know about psychology or trout fishing in Quebec or anything else.
Gary Cooper jumping on a couch? You can't imagine that?
It would have happened. There was a plasticity. And now we're seeing stars for what they really are, which is as more like real people.
My guests are Juliet Eilperin, national correspondent for The Washington Post, John McWhorter, senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute, and Jack Beatty, On Point news analyst and senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly. Let's step back to politics for a moment. Here's a statement from President Bush at his news conference this past week, asked if the Iraq war is an important election issue and if he would campaign against Joe Lieberman, a Democrat, now an independent, who supports Bush on the Iraq issue.
I'm staying out of Connecticut because, that's what the party suggested, the Republican Party of Connecticut. And plus, there's a better place to spend our money, time, and resources. Right. I listened to him very carefully. I'm a thoughtful guy. I listen to people. I'm open-minded. I'm all the things that you know I am. That other part of your question. Look, issues are won based upon whether or not you can keep this economy strong. Elections are won based upon economic issues and national security issues. And there's a fundamental difference between many of the Democrats and my party, and that is they want to leave before the job is completed in Iraq.
Juliet Eilperin, it seems to me that there's more than the normal amount of head-scratching going on in Washington as to how to deal with this Iraq issue in the upcoming election and even the economy. I mean, there was bad news on housing this week. What do you make of that?
I definitely think that's true. I mean, partially because there are divisions within both parties about what to do. But, I mean, you're exactly right. Washington's been buzzing with the fact that, a couple of weeks ago, people were saying Joe Lieberman, is being trounced in this primary. Surely he'll consider dropping out, given how all the high-profile Democrats are lining up behind his opponent, Ned Lamont. And here we see him having large leads in the polls. And it looks like with the help of Republicans and independents, he could very well pull it out in November. And so I think that, while you've seen people like John Kerry, obviously a Democrat from Massachusetts, move to the even further to the left and be more critical of Iraq, and you've seen those same kinds of sentiments coming out of Hillary Clinton, who might hope to be her party's standard bearer in 2008, I think there's still some concern of what's a unified position that Democratic candidates can have, let alone Republican candidates.
Jack Beatty, do you think this is an inchoate phenomenon among the electorate, or is it issue-based? In other words, are people just going to shoot down incumbents come this fall and the issue isn't going to really matter that much, or is it focused pretty much on Iraq from your view?
I just don't know is the question. I mean, polls show that Iraq is salient, but it also shows that the traditional issues, education, health care, the economy, are also salient. What struck me this week is a look at the generic polls. CBS had Democrats to the generic question, would you prefer a Democratic or Republican? Congress, CBS had 47-32 Democrats, CNN 52-43 Democrats. But what was interesting was a content analysis of 42 Democratic ads showed that only 10 of them mentioned the party. So it doesn't sound as if the Democrats are all that confident of victory, or if they want victory, they don't seem to want it under their own name. When you have only a fraction of the ads in this sample actually mentioning which party the person belongs to.
And we've seen that on the Republican side as well. Tons of Republican congressional candidates are running without mentioning their party, including the chairman of the National Republican Congressional Committee. So it's really kind of amazing.
Well, how does that work? Hi, I'm running for something. I'd like to do something to help you. Please elect me. I mean, it's just sort of generic campaign ads.
Right. Well, I think what it reflects is that both Democrats and Republicans realize that the national parties are unpopular to a large extent and aren't seen as responding to the needs of voters. And so as a result, a lot of these incumbents are falling back on the traditional, you like your local guy or woman. And so support me, even if you might think the Democrats and Republicans in Washington are a bit off.
Well, it reminds me, John, of the Wag the Dog campaign ads. Don't change horse in midstream. The utter genericism of the vote for the future kind of language as candidates are really scared to get down and be real.
Yeah, there is that. And I think that in this particular case, it's because the Iraq war has become one of those issues where it is not as much about just whether people are assessing the facts and where they come down on it and respecting that opinions might differ, but it's becoming a referendum on whether one is a good person or not. And that's always difficult because the Iraq war is a very complex issue. The arguments for pulling out make perfect sense on many levels. The arguments for staying, I personally do not think, renders one an unfit or an unreflective person. But that's not always easy to see because of the pitch of the debate, and so many people are just deciding to duck the whole thing because they want to get elected and do things based on things such as health care and other things that do remain urgent issues despite a horrible war that continues.
All right, I'm going to be John McLaughlin here. Where do you stand on Pluto? Jack Beatty.
I got no dog in
oh,
that.
Oh, come on. Come on. You have to. This is important. Are you pro-Pluto or anti-Pluto?
Well, you know, I think it's got to be unsettling for young people learning the planets. They've got them down straight, and then someone comes along and says something as, you know, eternal as the planets is up for conjecture. It's up for debate. It's pretty unsettling.
Although it should be said that Pluto actually doesn't know that its name is Pluto. John McWhorter, are you pro-Pluto or anti-Pluto?
I never really liked Pluto, to tell you the truth, with its moon that's practically the size of it, and they're kind of orbiting each other, and it's got too much ice in it. I mean, obviously, it's a matter of where do you draw the line, but it seems that there are definitely eight things that fit a certain prototypical definition, and then, you know, there's some dozens of other things that fit that prototype much less. And so, obviously, there are any number of cognitive systems we could use here, but I've always thought that this sort of 1930 add-on was a little arbitrary, and I kind of like there being eight, and eight's an even number.
Juliet, pro or anti-Pluto?
Yeah, I got to say, I'm with John. I'm not too broken up about this, but one of my colleagues in the newsroom told me yesterday I am a bad person and clearly insensitive to school children. So I'm admitting this with some hesitation, but again, I'm all for high standards, and I feel like eight is fine. People can come up with another mnemonic device to remember this. It's going to be easier for the kids because they're only going to have to remember eight planets instead.
That's right.
At the Washington Post water cooler, they're talking Pluto, folks. So, very, very quickly, what's more important, the Pluto name or JonBenet Ramsey? Come on, quickly. Let's get rid of the JonBenet Ramsey thing before
frankly,
I go to calls.
I think Pluto is much more interesting and important.
Okay, Juliet.
With all due sympathy for Ms. Ramsey.
I do. I'm accepting of the news because I think our long national nightmare will be over with JonBenet Ramsey soon, and I think that's good. Just get it done, figure out who did it, and move on.
Jack, quickly.
Well, I can't repeat the Daily Show skit on this, but anyone who can look somehow find it on the repeats, it was just hilarious and unprintable, but wonderful, and a spoof really on the media and on how they just pigged out on this horrifying event. And you know,
you're talking JonBenet, not Pluto, right?
Yeah, right.
Just want to get that clear. All right, let's take a call. Easy from Boston, you're on the air.
Yes, hello. I am completely ambivalent to the whole Pluto debate because I don't plan on visiting that part of the Milky Way anytime soon. However, as far as the whole Bush agenda is concerned, Americans need to realize that foreign policy and the whole international scene is not a video game. There are real consequences for our actions. Currently, the U.S. is going through a pension crisis, a healthcare crisis, and quite frankly, our deficit is something that's going to be dealt with by future generations. Now, the fact is that terrorism and religious, I guess you could call them fanatics or extremists, are premised on the fact that there is an evil empire, and pretty much for us not to be aware of the consciousness, the culture, the history, and I guess the pathologies that we're dealing with, pretty much means that while we believe that we defend in freedom, this only provides fodder and pretty much propaganda tools for the people that we're trying to win over.
You know, Izzy, it sounds to me like you've made up your mind about Bush at the very least.
No, actually, I'm completely open-minded. I respect Bush. I respect any statesman who is forward in the cause of their people. However misguided or not that perception might be, the fact is that truth is highly subjective.
All right,
and
Izzy.
While we might view from a lens that might be limited to Fox News, Al Jazeera and news agencies that feed the minds that we want to engage are pretty much more objective in the way they approach certain aspects of news.
Okay, all right, I got you. You know, it sounds to me, and you know, Jack referred to the spoofing of the, you know, JonBenet pig out on the media. I mean, there is such mistrust of content, either the motives of television going all JonBenet all the time, the kinds of sort of ideological issues that EZ is raising here. You know, this campaign seems to be very, very interesting in terms of how it's going to be covered and presented, Julianne.
Yeah, and I think one of the interesting questions will be with the rise of, for example, the online media, how that's going to affect this. I mean, in many ways, I think that blogs contribute to the political polarization we've seen in the country because it's very specific audiences that are being appealed to in the same way that the two parties are in, you know, below the radar are really appealing to the hardcore base voters. And so I think that you know, we'll see it. We saw it in the primary in Connecticut, you know, just this month, and I think we're going to be looking for it in the months ahead.
Mary from Iowa City, you're on the air.
Thank you. You know, Tom Cruise ain't news, and TV shows about races fighting each other, that's just noise to take us away from the real news. We're sliding back like we did before, prior to this invasion of Iraq. So we get so distracted about junk and movie stars until the world's falling apart around us.
Well, Mary, let me ask you one question. I mean, I don't particularly think that the Tom Cruise story is important. It's certainly an important business story in Los Angeles. But do you believe in principle that if somebody says something on a TV show that they should lose their job? I mean, he didn't say anything obscene. He didn't do anything illegal. And whether you think he's a nut or not, do you think Tom Cruise should lose his job or anyone should lose their job if they say something in public that embarrasses their boss?
No, but he didn't lose his job because of that. He lost his job because he's losing the studio money. And we can't get caught up in that kind of thing. What we need to be doing is watching the United States internally and watch the Russian Revolution. Russia was outside fighting China, and the people were home from any revolution. We have enough problems with immigration. We got that group like the SA going to patrol the Mexicans. We got the face of war. If you look at the face of war is white and male. And you look at the news shows, everybody, the pundits are mostly white. Once in a while we have a few blacks. We're falling back instead of going forward.
All right, Mary, thank you very much for calling. John McWhorter, what do you think of that?
I understand completely what Mary means, but I have a slightly different ideal, or maybe we actually agree. Yes, Tom Cruise and, you know, people running around on Survivor and various things like that do occupy too much of our attention often. Ideally, I would like to see a media more focused on substantial issues, but I suspect that if our main focus was on a notion of us versus them and warily watching for evil, cigar-chomping, mostly white male plutocrats trying to rule the world and do in the subalterns, as academics call it, I get the feeling that wouldn't necessarily correspond with the range of the facts, and that I would hope that in that ideal kind of world where the media paid attention to things, all of us would do the work of realizing that life is generally more complicated than that. But I basically agree with what Mary is saying.
All right, here's a quick story I want to get to here before the break. You know, we had the allusion to the stem cell issue that I want to come back to out of this, but we also had some news regarding the morning after pill, the Plan B pill. Girls 17 and younger will still need a doctor's note to buy the pills. Wendy Wright, president of Concerned Women for America, says there's no real way to enforce that.
The FDA expects the drug company to enforce the age restriction, and yet the drug company has admitted it has no intention of enforcing it. So an 18-year-old could buy the drug and even write in the store, turn around and give it to a 13-year-old girl.
Juliette Alpern, is this a compromise coming out of Washington on a controversial moral subject in advance of the election, or is there really just a medical story here?
Oh, it's definitely, to some extent, it's a compromise, and particularly two senators, Hillary Clinton and Patty Murray, have pushed very hard and held up an administration nomination over this issue. So they have not, you know, I would say in many ways this is a victory for the abortion rights advocates and the people who back wider contraception availability. And so, but, you know, it does show you, again, like stem cells, how sometimes there may be a way out of some of these more controversial issues, even though you're still going to have people angered, like people from the Concerned Women for America.
Jack Beatty, does this end the Plan B story and the stem cell story, this sort of scientific compromise, or is it going to go on?
I think it'll go on, at least the initial reaction from some of the anti-abortion groups suggested it would, and indeed from the White House there was a statement that this wasn't quite, this, they didn't see this as a satisfactory compromise, that there were just basic beliefs here involved, and one little cell is as much as another. You know, this is really just constituent politics. This is, you know, I mean, this is obviously an element of the Republican base, and they voted for what they're going to get, and that's what they want. You know, if I might just for a minute go back to Mary's point, I think she made a very good point, and that is the elite focus, and not so much focus, character of the media. That continues, I think. You know, there are whole ranges of realities that never get mentioned on television because people don't live in a world where, say, the minimum wage matters, where, say, you know, $20 to take a cab is an impossibility, where people have to ride the subway. They live in another world. And that is, I think, more and more Americans feel, my gosh, we're not hearing about the world we live in because these Panjandra, multimillionaires who go on the television, they live in a different world. And I think she's absolutely right. Not only don't we hear about minorities, but we just don't hear about the grit of life where most people live. And I think that is one of the reasons the media is so distrusted, that it's so irrelevant in the things it talks about.
Well, with all due respect, Jack, what's your proximity to the grit? I mean, are you down with the Mary there? I mean, you're not a multimillionaire, I don't think, but are you part of the elite?
Gee, I would hate to think I am, but I suppose so. And then I earn my living sitting down on my duff and talking. So, yeah, I guess I do qualify.
We're going to go to Donald from Buffalo, New York. Donald, you're on the air.
Yes. I'm surprised that your guests didn't bring up the fact that there was a staged event at the White House between this gentleman from New Orleans and the President Bush, and praising President Bush like, you know, he just saved New Orleans from disaster. And obviously, by the way, the gentleman from New Orleans is a Republican also.
All right, good point. You know, I missed that photo op. Did anyone check that out, Jack?
Yeah, well, the man was, I didn't see it either myself, but from what I've read, he was an owner or proprietor of, I don't know, 40 or more Pizza Hut restaurants, and a former candidate for office in one of the parishes there as a Republican. So he was a Republican in that sense. But he didn't just lionize the president. He also reminded them there are people still hurting and still need your help.
You know, we talked a lot about the Middle East and Iran this week on earlier programs. I noticed that it hasn't come up yet. Is it possible that Iran and this whole confrontation that is a diplomatic example of brinksmanship going on and the crisis in Lebanon just isn't breaking through to Americans in a sleepy kind of August? What's the view in Washington, Juliet?
I think part of it is that in terms of Iran, a lot of it is very abstract, this kind of arguments over, you know, and uncertainty that exists about how close Iran is to developing nuclear weapons. Steve Call, a former Post reporter and editor, had a long piece about this in The New Yorker, which I also subscribe to, putting me as part of the media elite, just a week or two ago. And I think part of it is that it's hard for people to know how seriously to take that. Whereas I think Lebanon, particularly people of Lebanese descent, you know, that's something that does resonate with people. And I just think there becomes a little bit of a news fatigue when you have that on the front page day after day. Particularly when there is a ceasefire, I think people just in some ways need a break and don't focus on it for a temporary amount and then probably will return.
Just in the interest of full disclosure, I buy my New Yorker at the newsstand, so I am one of the people. John McWhorter, is it possible that Americans in this crisis are seeing a decline in American influence and that's the implicit news here, regardless of the facts and figures about crisis and nuclear technology?
That's certainly possible, especially in the case of Lebanon and Iran. where clearly American influence is less than it used to be, and there's a certain frustration. There's also a certain lack of what you might call media-friendly dramatic thrust. It seems that no matter what we say to Iran, there is this intransigence, a certain kind of rhetoric. It's difficult to tell whether they mean what they say because their use of public language is different from ours. And then when it comes to Lebanon, there's the rather depressing fact that our official statement originally was that we're not going to work for a ceasefire because it wouldn't be practical, when really we were just hoping that Israel would do as much damage as possible. Those sorts of things are difficult to focus upon because they're so unpleasant, not to mention not dramatic. And so, yes, we are kind of in the dark about those things in this August month.
Mike is from Atlanta, Georgia. You're on the air.
Hi. I'm a little bit surprised the media are taking the claims by advanced cell technology at face value.
On the stem cell story.
Exactly. Yeah. I'm sorry, I didn't introduce that.
That's right.
Given that this same company made claims a few years ago that were widely dismissed as invalid, I'm wondering, is anyone in the media questioning the scientific validity of what they're saying, given that they have a past history of making far-fetched claims?
You know, that's an interesting point. Jack Beatty, does the politics of the potential of this breakthrough get in the way of evaluating it in scientific terms?
I don't know about the company, so I really just can't say. I mean, I hadn't heard that, but obviously the media should look into that. I mean, there have been too many of these scientific, if not frauds, then premature enthusiasms about things that didn't pan out.
Glenn. Although, go ahead, John.
I was just going to say, although I may be naive, but I'm not sure what the media could do other than what they usually do in cases like this, which is to cite the opinions of established and professional scientists. And so it seems that it's a matter of gradual sifting to see whether there's some sort of rot underneath what experts in science are telling us about.
Yeah, well, you're only as good as your expert witness on scientific and technical stories. That is true. Glenn is calling from Providence, Rhode Island. You're on the air.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for taking my call. I'm calling because it seems ironic to me that Iran played all the game correctly. It developed its nuclear energy under the auspices of the IAEA and played the game by allowing inspections and said it was developing nuclear technology. And, you know, and here it is being completely vilified, whereas Pakistan, India, Israel all developed a nuclear bomb completely surreptitiously, and yet, you know, it seems very hypocritical that the U.S. would be picking on Iran when they're actually playing the game correctly.
Doesn't it matter that Iran keeps saying that Israel should not exist, though?
No.
That plays into the equation, doesn't it?
It doesn't matter what they say. The treaty is quite specific, and they're playing the game by the international treaty. And it's very easy for me to see the country being able to say, look, you know, we're doing what you tell us, and we're developing peaceful nuclear technology, which we're allowed to do under the international auspices of this treaty, so why should we be vilified?
Well, that means that it doesn't matter what we say from America when we talk about, say, an axis of evil or various things. It seems we pay a lot of attention to what our president says,
okay,
whether or not it has
any.
Look
at it this way. Pakistan, I think, probably generally speaking, is the number one breeding ground for terrorist groups in the world.
Well, let's just confine it to terrorism related to Kashmir and, you know, I would say terrorism associated with South Asia. I think you might be stretching it. You know, Hezbollah is a pretty big organization in the South Lebanon that might compete with the Pakistanis. But go ahead.
Okay. So how about granting the point that there are plenty of terrorists in Pakistan, including camps where they're training Hezbollah fighters and sending them back to South Lebanon, and yet we're not the least bit concerned. In fact, not only are we not the least bit concerned, we are working hand in hand with the Pakistanis And there's absolutely no problem with us working with the government of Pakistan, which has a nuclear bomb.
Great. Glenn, thank you very much for calling. Glenn is certainly describing the difficulties of maintaining any kind of consistency in nonproliferation, John. I mean, he's got that point.
Oh, certainly. I mean, with Pakistan, obviously, there's the realpolitik of the fact that it has a certain geographical adjacency to Afghanistan, where there's certain well-known problems. But it seems to me that Iran is certainly one of various places that we should be paying attention to because of its position on Israel, as well as obviously its connections with Hezbollah. But of course, Glenn's point about inconsistency is taken.
But I think Glenn raises something else, which is that many people feel that we're now in an Iraq phase, a pre-Iraq war phase vis-a-vis Iran. Seymour Hersh has been having several dispatches in the New Yorker saying that there are plans. The military, that Bush has ordered plans to attack these sites in Iran, that he believes he's a man of destiny he doesn't do this, no one will.
It's hard for me to take that seriously. I mean, I read Hersh's piece, and I'm sure his sources are good. But, I mean, the idea that you would take military action against Iran, I mean, you're creating a gigantic hostage crisis for the 135,000 soldiers, U.S. soldiers in Iraq, if you attack Iran. I just don't see how it could ever happen.
I couldn't agree more, but I'm just saying that there are these signs that are worrisome.
Yeah.
And this week, the House Intelligence Committee came out with a majority report. The Democrats didn't sign it, saying, we've got to have more cutting edge, a little more tougher intelligence from the intelligence community about Iran. And again, they're saying, get with it, Langley. We want just as Dick Cheney was saying to them, get with it before Iraq. We want to get tougher information about what's going on in Iraq.
Yeah.
And of course,
Juliet, do you hear the war drums beating in Washington?
Iran? I mean, again, it's unclear what's going to happen, but there's no question that this administration, with a few exceptions, has been increasingly confrontational towards Iran, and I think people do see an attack as a real possibility before the end of this administration.
Let's go back to Tom Cruise, please. George is calling from Farmington, Connecticut. You're on the air, George.
Good morning to you all.
Go ahead, George.
I wanted to just make a comment, and then I wanted to ask a question. I wanted, first of all, the comment I have is that unfortunately, because of the way that the business of reporting is, reporters don't have time to get into the real stories behind the stories. And frequently what I see, and I always shake my head at this, having been a reporter many years ago, is that you find a story comes up and it's printed in one of the major feeds, and it's sprinkled all over the world. And frequently it'll have errors in it. It will have less than good investigation. And I think that really is a disservice to the public, especially when it comes to understanding what is happening in places like the Middle East and Kashmir and other hotspots.
Okay, what's your question?
My question to the panel is, do you agree with me that there are two keystrokes in the war on terror which have not been played? One is to equitably solve the Middle East crisis, and secondly, to equitably resolve the Kashmir crisis.
Okay, George, thanks for calling. It's a tall order George has laid out there, but what do you think, John?
Well, I think that these things are a little too complex for it to be something that would be quick and simple. Obviously, the Kashmir crisis, for example, is important, but not only are claims on both sides difficult to simply swat away as unjustified, but I would think that Kashmir is one of a great many crises around the world that do not get the kind of attention that one does simply because. So, for example, what's going on in Timor right now is just as high-pitched and complex and regrettable as things that are going on in Kashmir.
Although, Jack Beatty, George does make the point that if if the U.S. perhaps took a kind of summit approach to the Middle East, which is certainly something that's been done in the past, or a summit approach to Kashmir, which has never really been tried, that you'd have at least the potential for bracketing a process for peace from South Asia to the Eastern Mediterranean. Would you go along with that?
Yes, if you involve the major players, which would be Iran and Syria. We can't get anywhere in Iraq without talking to Iran. That's just going to deteriorate unless we do. But, you know, he talks about an equitable settlement. One of the casualties of this Lebanon war, whether it was right or wrong, is that the United States, for the first time, did not try to stop the fighting. We have intervened. We have sent our diplomats. We have gone to all kinds of lengths to prevent the heating up of Arab-Israeli wars.
And not this time.
Not this time. Yeah. And there was a Pakistani journalist being interviewed the other day who said, you know, you look at the press in that part of the world, and they are just saying, United States, you don't care about democracy. Lebanon was a democracy, and you can't be even-handed. You have no, you're not an honest broker in this. Any pretense that you had to be an honest broker has just gone away.
Perhaps we don't have the influence to even attempt those kinds of initiatives. I'm wondering where the pro Pluto callers are, but I'm going to go to Joe from Somerville, Mass. Joe, you're on the air.
Hi, I'm a pro Pluto person myself.
Nice. Thanks for calling.
Well, hey, but also what I wanted to talk about was just the recent ruling of that judge on the NSA cases, where she had stated that the wiretapping was illegal. And I find it interesting that Karl Rove, of course, you know, being here in Massachusetts, the land of the activist judge, has leveled, of course, the charge against her that she's an activist and, you know, actively promoting terrorism, when in fact, you know, he made the statement that if they had had this wiretapping capability prior to 9/11, something could have been done. When in fact, all of that information was available to the administration, they did know that this thing was coming down the pike. And of course, our hero was busy hanging out in Crawford and not reading anything.
All right, Joe, thanks for calling. Juliet, is there a war going on between the judiciary and the executive at this point?
Well, you know, to some extent there is, but I find this interesting. Generally, it's people who are more liberal who have been concerned about activism by conservative judges. So I find it interesting that the Bush administration, who's been quite pleased with that kind of activism, now has problems with it when it's someone who's more liberal, who's obviously challenging the constitutionality of what they're doing. So I don't think people take what Karl Rove is saying that seriously, given the fact that, first of all, I think this judge is well respected. And also, you know, it's obvious you'd be angry if one of your key policies was declared unconstitutional.
It's unfortunate, though, isn't it, that the judge ruling in a case where the ACLU was one of the plaintiffs, was in fact a board member of an ACLU organization in Michigan. And didn't sort of recuse herself or make that clear. That had to be turned up in the press. That really is unfortunate.
But it's going to be taken up on appeal. We're almost out of time. I want to get a last word from John McWhorter. Give us a thought for what's going to happen next week that concerns you.
Well, next week I'll be interested to see, for example, what more is said about these supposed hate speech cases, of course. And I am very interested, actually, more than anything, in what goes on in our dialogue with Iran and their answer to the ultimatum that we have put to them.
Well, we'll all be interested. Guys, thanks so much for hanging around with me this hour. This has been terrific. Juliet, John, and Jack, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
My guest this hour, Juliet Alperin, national correspondent for The Washington Post and author of Fight Club Politics, John McWhorter, senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute. His book is Winning the Race. On Point News analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at The Atlantic Monthly. I'm John Hockenberry, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point.